Hello and welcome to Science World. The planet Mars is in the news this week. Coming up, Jessica Berman and Suzanne Presto tells us about new radiation findings made by NASA's Mars rover Curiosity and the impact it may have on plans to send a manned mission to the Red Planet. The robotic explorer has also provided clues of an ancient stream bed on the Martian surface. We'll talk with one of the scientists involved with this remarkable discovery later in our one-on-one segment. And since we seem to be in a Martian kind of mood this week, our brain teaser for you on the Science World Quick Quiz will be about our planetary neighbor. This and more coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. Researchers have published new data showing that long-distance space travel would pose serious health risks to astronauts because of the exposure to deep space radiation. The finding is based on measurements from an instrument aboard the spacecraft that carried the Curiosity rover called the Radiation Assessment Detector. This device measured harmful radiation that a space crew would be subjected to during the long journey. Jessica Berman has more.
From the time the U.S. space agency NASA launched its Mars Space Laboratory in November 2011 until the time it touched down on the Red Planet, an instrument called the Radiation Assessment Detector, or RAD, took detailed measurements of high-energy particles that would bathe astronauts on a deep space mission. Radiation exposure on a trip to Mars, or a six-month stint aboard the International Space Station, has long been a concern to space scientists. Carrie Zeitlin at Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, Texas, and colleagues analyzed the RAD data collected during a 253-day, 560 million kilometer journey to Mars. The heavily shielded instrument, similar to the protection of a spacesuit, recorded the amount of onboard radiation exposure that would be expected to hit humans traveling to Mars or other deep space destinations. They found the amount of radiation exposure was a large fraction of what is considered an acceptable lifetime limit.
The concern is not so much any immediate effects on people, although those are possible, but long-term health effects like cancer or damage to the central nervous system.
Zeitlin made his comments in a podcast interview with the journal Science, which published the study. Humans would be exposed to two types of radiation on board the spacecraft: constant low-energy particles called galactic cosmic rays, or GCRs, and solar particle radiation, which fluctuates with sunspot activity. The amount of accumulated radiation exposure for astronauts on a round trip to Mars, according to Zeitlin, would be the equivalent of getting a whole-body CT scan every 5 to 6 days. It might be possible to beef up protective gear and improve the insulation of spacecraft to better protect astronauts against solar radiation. But Zeitlin says constant exposure to cosmic rays poses a more difficult problem.
They can typically go through several inches of solid matter shielding without being attenuated very much. So astronauts in deep space will get a continuous low radiation dose.
Zeitlin and colleagues will continue to take radiation measurements as the Curiosity rover bumps along the Martian surface. Researchers want to get a complete picture of the radiation risks to humans who would spend time on the Red Planet if and when a mission is undertaken. I'm Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Meanwhile, NASA is taking those research findings to help it shape plans for a manned mission to Mars. Suzanne Presto tells us how NASA is putting the information from the recent radiation findings to use in developing technology that will allow for safe human travel into deep space.
NASA has plans to send humans to Mars in the mid-2030s. And it's a feat that poses both technical and medical challenges. New findings published in the journal Science indicate a trip to Mars could subject space travelers to more radiation than NASA allows. Long-standing research shows that exposure to radiation increases a person's risk of developing cancer. Scientists say one way to reduce radiation exposure is to develop new propulsion technologies that would shorten the time it takes to get to Mars. thereby reducing the time a person is subjected to radiation in deep space. NASA's Deputy Director of Advanced Exploration Systems, Chris Moore, says engineers are working on advanced systems that could cut a one-way trip to Mars down from about 250 days to 180 days.
To get a really fast trip times and cut down on the radiation exposure, we would probably need nuclear thermal propulsion. And we're working with the U.S. Department of Energy now to look at various types of fuel elements for these rockets, but it's a long-range technology development activity, and it will probably be many years before that is ready.
Moore emphasized that nuclear thermal propulsion is part of the current plan to get humans to Mars. During the journey through deep space, astronauts would be exposed to two types of radiation that pose potential risks. Galactic cosmic rays are caused by supernova explosions and other high-energy events outside the solar system. Solar energetic particles are linked to solar flares and coronal mass ejections from the sun. Eddie Simones, the spaceflight radiation health officer at NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, says this requires a two-pronged mitigation approach. Simones says deployable shields are effective at reducing the effects of solar particle events because those events are low energy. But he says in order to reduce the effect of high-energy galactic cosmic rays, shields would have to be meters thick. Too thick for a spacecraft to launch successfully from Earth.
We need to get there faster to reduce the impact of the galactic cosmic rays, but we need to have shielding, local shielding on board to eliminate the effects of solar particle events. So it's hand in hand.
The Curiosity rover's radiation assessment detector continued to take measurements after it landed on the Martian surface in August. NASA says the medical community is using the radiation data to develop exposure limits for deep space explorers. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
We just told you about NASA's latest radiation findings from the Curiosity rover and the danger astronauts face if sent on long trips into deep space. In a few minutes, we'll hear from a geologist with NASA's Mars Exploration Program whose team of scientists just found clues of an ancient stream bed, which could mean that water, and possibly lots of it, once flowed on the red planet. So the theme for the quick quiz is, of course, Mars. What we want to know today is, what do scientists say gives the red planet's soil its reddish-orange color? Does it come from large deposits of A, silicon dioxide, B, iron oxide, or C, copper? Do you think you have the right answer? We'll fill you in with the correct answer in just a little bit.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Virtually non-existent two decades ago, cybercrime has become one of the fastest-growing criminal enterprises around the world. Estimates peg the global cost of crimes ranging from malicious software, called malware, to data theft at about $100 billion a year. And it's growing. Efforts to combat the problem have taken on urgency, but as Mil Arcega reports, there is growing debate on how best to foil high-tech offenders.
It doesn't matter who you are or where you live. If you have access to a computer, you're a potential target for cyber criminals. And it's not just individuals at risk. Earlier this month, U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District of New York, Loretta Lynch, charged eight people for launching cyber attacks on foreign banks that could have netted $45 million.
This was a 21st century bank heist that reached through the internet to span the globe. But instead of guns and masks, this cybercrime organization used laptops and malware.
Alan Edwards, president of the web security consulting firm Whitehorse Technology Solutions, says the foiled heist and recent revelations that U.S. missile defense systems may have been breached by Chinese hackers underscore the growing sophistication of cyber criminals.
They've changed from being 14-year-old geniuses who are bored just trying to crash a system and cause you trouble to now it's organized crime and government-sponsored, quite frankly.
Edwards' company specializes in providing real-time web traffic security and monitoring. He says not everyone likes the added expense to pay for this until they realize a successful attack would cost much more.
Unfortunately, it's like car insurance or any other insurance. You really hate paying for it until you have an accident.
While beefed up, network security is crucial. Here at the University of Maryland, criminology professor David Maimon says that's only half the solution.
The way we're doing things right now in computer science and in our attempt to solve this issue is by simply focusing on the network and the computers. And that will be the equivalent of a criminologist trying to figure out why an individual committed a crime by focusing on the gun or the door.
Among Maimon's more controversial findings is the correlation between the number of foreign students logged into the college network and the frequency and origin of the cyber attacks.
In other words, what we find is that increasing the number of foreign students that arrive from specific countries increases the probability of our campus to receive attacks from that specific countries by around 40%.
Maimon says more research is needed, but one explanation may be that foreign students are surfing compromised websites in their own countries, giving hackers new pathways to exploit. Maimon's research hopes to break new ground by examining the motivations behind recent cyber attacks and how potential victims' online behavior can enable or discourage future attacks. Millar Sega, VOA News, Washington.
The iPhone has become a status symbol in much of the developing world, but smartphones and media tablets are falling in price as low-cost Chinese developers gain ground. Ralph Jennings has this report from Taipei.
Hikers often explore the foothills of the Angeles National Forest, but this group of hikers has a purpose. They are learning how Native Americans used the local vegetation in their healing, including plants like Yerba Santa, adopted by early Spanish settlers for lung problems. The hike is led by James Adams, who teaches pharmacology at the University of Southern California.
The science of pharmacology originally was the science of going out, talking to traditional healers, finding out which plants they use in their healing, and then taking those plants back to the lab to figure out why they work.
Aspirin, for example, was derived in the 19th century from salicylic acid, a longtime remedy for pains and fever found in plants like willow and meadowsweet. It was developed and marketed by the German company Bayer. Adams says each society has developed a form of medicine based on plants.
Of course, in India they have Ayurvedic medicine. In China they have traditional Chinese medicine. In the Arabic countries they have traditional Arabic healing. The Jews have traditional Judaic healing, on and on. Everybody has their own traditional healing that depends on plant medicines.
In California, Adams says, the Chumash people learned from experience which plants helped with specific ailments.
We have, of course, the sagebrush that makes a very powerful pain-relieving liniment that I think we should all learn how to use because it's much safer than the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents. It's much safer than the opioid drugs.
Besides easing aches and pains, Adams says the pleasant aroma of the California sagebrush helps people relax. Adams warns that some plants are poisonous and says knowledge of vegetation is essential. He learned traditional native healing from a Chumash healer and sometimes takes plant samples back to his laboratory to learn how they work. He says modern pharmaceuticals remain important in medicine, but are often overused and can be harmful. Adams says good diet and exercise are two keys to a healthy life, and that an educational hike looking for medicinal plants is another good way to keep the body in balance. Mike O'Sullivan, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Many modern medicines have their origin in natural remedies, and some researchers say traditional herbal cures hold clues for modern medicine. Mike O'Sullivan reports that a pharmacology professor who studies Native American healing is sharing what he has learned.
The confidential Pentagon report, quoted by the Washington Post, gives the most detailed list yet of the systems that Chinese hackers allegedly have penetrated. Missile defense systems, including the Patriot, THAAD, and Aegis systems, cutting-edge aircraft such as the Joint Strike Fighter now in development, the F-35, and Ospreys. The question now is how Washington will respond to what analysts say are Beijing's cyber intrusions. In a State of the Union address early this year, President Obama addressed the issue.
We know foreign countries and companies swipe our corporate secrets. Now our enemies are also seeking the ability to sabotage our power grid, our financial institutions, our air traffic control systems. We cannot look back years from now and wonder why we did nothing in the face of real threats to our security and our economy.
That threat has grown as China modernizes its military and looks for ways to develop its own weapon systems. Jason Healy specializes in cybersecurity at the Atlantic Council, a research organization in Washington.
We know the Chinese have been greatly expanding their defense procurement programs over the last few years. This completely fits in with what we've seen in other areas of Chinese military behavior.
In their meetings with Chinese officials, U.S. officials have for years brought up the issue of cyber intrusions. But the U.S. government has only recently started making its complaints more public.
6 months ago, the United States still had not taken a position on what we would do about this. Now, the United States government has made the position from the president on down that we will confront the Chinese mostly in private, but also slightly in public about this.
The Pentagon says it takes the threat of cyber espionage very seriously and has taken steps to strengthen its capabilities. Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel will have a chance to bring up the issue with Chinese defense officials when he attends an Asian security summit in Singapore in the coming days. Luis Ramirez, VOA News, at the Pentagon.
Okay, let's see if you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz. We wanted to know what scientists say gives the surface of Mars its reddish-orange color. Does it come from large deposits of A, silicon dioxide, B, iron oxide, or C, copper? Well, the answer is B, iron oxide or rust. According to NASA, oxygen from water and from carbon dioxide in the atmosphere combined with minerals, mostly iron, in the rocks, dust, and soil, and formed iron oxide, which gives Mars its reddish color. By the way, the pink Martian sky is caused by fine red dust that is suspended in its atmosphere. Thanks for playing this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We're going to have another brain teaser for you again next week.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Ever since its rover Curiosity touched down on the surface of Mars last August, the Mars Science Laboratory mission has been a huge success for NASA's Mars Exploration Program. Now, in a study just published by the journal Science, a team of scientists has found geological signs of an ancient stream bed indicating that water once flowed on the Red Planet, which they say supports prospects that the planet could have once been able to host life. Using basic geologic principles in making their discovery, the scientists found rounded pebbles, which are known to form only when transported through water over long distances. The study was co-authored by Dawn Sumner, a geologist and professor at the University of California. She's also a co-investigator for the Mars Science Laboratory team. Professor Sumner joins us today for our one-on-one segment to talk about her team's recent discovery and the role geology is playing in Curiosity's goal of determining the habitability of Mars. Professor, I must admit that reading the headline, "Ancient Stream Bed Found on the Surface of Mars," really caught my eye. What did you and your colleagues find?
We found rounded pebbles, and it's something you find in stream beds all over Earth, and they're very common, but we've never seen these on Mars.
And where on Mars did you find it?
We found them in Gale Crater at the landing site of the Curiosity rover.
And I understand that you played a key role in selecting the Curiosity's landing site. Why was Gale Crater selected?
We actually selected it because there's this mountain in the middle of the crater called Mount Sharp that has layers of rocks. And those layers record the history of time and the environments in Gale Crater. And so we landed in a flat area near the mountain because you can't land on a steep slope. And we planned to drive to the base of the mountain to look at those layers.
Professor, I understand that this discovery was made with using the very basic principle of geology. Can you please tell us about them?
Yes. So the pebbles are rounded. And when you break up a rock, the edges tend to be sharp. To get them rounded, they have to collide with each other and collide with sand. And they do that when they're transported down the stream bed. And it takes a lot of collisions to make rocks round. And so it's a very basic principle. That's the first lab I teach in my class to geology majors, that to get rounded pebbles, they have to be transported a lot.
What does this finding show you and your colleagues?
This is some of the first proof on the ground that there was flowing water on Mars that lasted a long time in transported sediment a long distance. So a flash flood, just one or two flash floods, can't round pebbles like this. It requires more continuous water flow with the pebbles banging against each other. So that means there was water flowing on Mars for an extended period of time.
So speaking of which, finding this stream bed with the geological clues your team uncovered, have you been able to determine or at least hazard a guess as to when water might have flowed across it?
Well, we don't know the actual age when these rocks were deposited. We know that it's more than 2 billion years ago, maybe 3 billion years ago. Getting the age is very difficult, something we all want to know, but it was early in Mars history.
The Mars Science Laboratory mission with the Curiosity rover is quite unique in that it's using the science of geology to help answer some important questions on the Red Planet. Mostly, was it able to ever host life? Can you share some of your thoughts on this mission from a geologist's perspective?
It's thrilling to be able to do geology on another planet. And we've had a taste of this with other missions. We can look at the planets and use telescopes and remote sensing to get a lot of information. And that's how we knew Gale Crater was a good place to go. But the rocks on Earth and on Mars record clues to what happened billions of years ago. And as geologists, we're trained to interpret those. And with the engineering team, we've built and landed and are operating an amazing field geologist that also has some great lab chemistry experiments.
Professor Sumner, I understand that you helped coordinate the first scientific interpretations of what was seen during Curiosity's first few days on Mars. You helped direct the rover by computer and shoot photographs of the planet. Now, as a geologist involved in such a key role with the MSL mission, how do you determine where the rover should go, what it should explore, and where samples should be taken?
Well, that's something that we do every day, and it's a lot of careful observation. We take the pictures to be able to see where we are, and when we first landed, we saw pictures of these rounded pebbles, and we talked as a team. There are several hundred people on the team. We talk as a team about what they mean, and then a few people who are really interested in the problem work together to figure out what observations do we need to do next. And so it's a big collaborative effort with lots of discussion, and eventually we have to come to consensus about where to go and what to do.
I'm quite curious, Professor Sumner. I know that the mission itself has a number of goals it hopes to reach. Do you have any personal goals you hope to accomplish with your involvement with the mission?
My biggest personal goal I've actually reached already and will continue to, which is to learn something that's brand new. As a scientist, I really enjoy